On this podcast, we're going to talk about the business of planning. Hopefully, you had a chance to listen to my podcast about a good death. Not necessarily everybody's good death, but my good death, how I see myself dying, I guess. If not, that's perfectly okay. It'll be there when you want to listen to it. But when thinking about a good death, there's one thing you really need to do: plan. And then plan some more. And then plan to make adjustments to those plans that you already have planned out. You can never really be over-prepared for death. We only get one chance at it, so you know. With all of that planning, it's best you start sooner rather than later. So what are we planning and where do we start? There's really not one place that I would suggest you start. I only suggest that you do start. Sit back and think about what's important to you. Whatever comes up, that's where you begin. There's no specific checklist, just somewhat of a general consensus of what is usually needed. So I guess there is kind of an unofficial checklist, but nothing really set in stone outside of a few things. Those few things that I'm talking about, those are, in my opinion, an absolute must. I'll only touch on a few, just enough to hopefully get your wheels turning. I'll start with accounts. Any kind of account information that someone would need in the event of your death, you want to make sure that you write that down or type them up, passwords, account numbers, and store it in a safe place. If you already have a person that you have signed to take care of you and all of your affairs when you die, then give them a copy of that information if you trust them to hold on to it while you're still living. But make sure that you have a copy stored away somewhere that they can find in the event that they happen to lose their copy, which hopefully they don't, because they're responsible enough to keep track of that very important information. Or in the event that something happens suddenly and they just can't really think straight. Death has a way of making us forget even the most important things. No matter how many times you go over it in your head, when you're faced with sorrow and grief, sometimes your brain just doesn't work like you want it to. Some of the account information you should document are bank accounts, credit card accounts, loan accounts, definitely life insurance and beneficiary information. Bank account information can be tricky though, especially if there is a will that divvies up where the money goes or who gets what. In that case, even if you had access to the person's bank account, it may be illegal for you to take money out without going through the process of probate court and having the will be verified. Check with your local estate lawyers and see what the laws are, because I am not a lawyer, so I can't legally advise you on how to proceed with that. There is a way that you can avoid this, though. Many banks let you name a beneficiary or someone who is payable upon death. There may be other terms for it, but that's the one I know. Whoever you name, the bank allows them to access your account once your death has been verified, usually by taking a certified copy of the death certificate to the bank. If you have total trust in the person that you're leaving your affairs to, or maybe if it's a spouse or something like that, you could just add them to your account outright. I do suggest, while you are setting this up, to find out everything that you need to know about your banking institution's requirements, as what I am saying is solely based off the knowledge that I have about my bank account. Since I mentioned death certificates, I'll throw this in there real quick. When a person dies, there is sometimes a wait or a processing period for the death certificate, kind of like when a child is born and you don't get the birth certificate right away. Some states can be as quick as same day, with states like California, where I currently live, taking as long as 4 weeks. Other factors also go into the length of time that you have to wait, like if the medical examiner has to wait for test results, if the death was untimely and an autopsy was ordered, the size of the community that's being serviced, and some other factors can play into how long it takes you to actually get your death certificate. Not necessarily your death certificate, the death certificate of the person who has died. Make sense? Be sure to request more than one copy, just in case, because some places may require a certified copy and you don't want to submit the only one that you have. You also want to make sure that you have the deceased person information readily available to make filling out paperwork or request forms easier. It's important to know that there will be certain accounts that will require payment upon death. A really easy yet sometimes seemingly impossible way to make sure that your family isn't left with tons of debt is to do your best to die without any. Now, whether that's possible for you or not, I'm not sure. That's my goal, but I don't even know if it's possible for me at this moment. However, your family will more than likely not be stuck paying off all of your debts from their personal accounts when you die. If there are bills that need to be paid, they will more than likely be paid out of your estate. Whoever is responsible for overseeing your estate should ensure that all of the creditors have been paid. Now, when I say estate, please know that the estate can be anything like money or property that can be sold to pay any outstanding debts. In the event that there are not enough assets within the estate, the debt will more than likely not be passed on to the family, but it can affect any inheritance that you may be entitled to. This will all be determined in probate court. If you are a co-signer, you are just as responsible as the person who died. So in this instance, you'll still be required to pay the debt. There is some good news in all of this talking about dying in debt. There are a few things the creditors cannot touch, like life insurance policies and bank accounts that are labeled payable upon death. Remember, always, always, always check the laws and requirements in your area, because I'm not a lawyer and I can't give you legal advice. Gotta throw that disclaimer in there from time to time. Another important part of death planning is advance directives. Advance directives are usually either written or orally communicated, though written is better, of course. This directive tells your family and your healthcare professionals what you would want if you are unable to speak for yourself. And if you are in any kind of accident or you become unconscious for some reason, any circumstance that you can't use your voice, that's what these documents are for. It's basically a set of instructions on how to proceed as if you were conscious and speaking for yourself. A lot of people shy away from advance directives because they think that they cannot be changed, but that's a huge misconception. You can change them as often as you please. Say if you wanted to be an organ donor and that was annotated, but for some reason now you decide that that's not what you want at all, you can change it to say so. When I ask people what they have done to prepare or plan ahead in the event of a death or severe illness, a lot of people say, I have a living will. When what they really mean to say is that they have an advance directive. A living will is definitely a type of advance directive, but living wills are usually reserved for terminal illnesses where you can no longer make your own decisions at all. Some things that can be included in a living will is how long you want to be kept on life support, or what kind of treatments that you would like if you are permanently unconscious. Please understand that an advance directive may be overridden in the event that the doctor or medical staff feels that there are better or more viable options. So again, check with your local area. A living will is enacted in the event of a terminal illness and can be included in your advance care directive. Another item that can be part of your advance care directive is a POST, or portable order of life-sustaining treatment. MOLST, M-O-L-S-T, medical order for life-sustaining treatment. Somewhat of the same thing, the terminology really just depends on the state. These forms and orders are usually where you'll find your DNRs, or do not resuscitate, DNIs, which means do not intubate. The POST and MOLST forms are filled out by you and your medical care team, not you and your family or friends. These forms are usually reserved for the elderly or terminally ill persons, but most states don't have any set age restrictions, just that you have to be terminally ill. And don't forget to update your forms when you change doctor. The last thing I want to touch on is a medical power of attorney, or power of attorney for healthcare. This is a legal document, just so you know. Another important thing to know about this power of attorney is that you're not giving the person permission to make medical decisions for you unless you have not talked to them and they kind of got a guess about what you want. But more importantly, if you have had those conversations, you are giving them the power to enforce or implement what you have already spoken about in the event that you are unable to speak for yourself, which is extremely important because you don't want people guessing. This person can be a next of kin, a really close friend, or even a distant cousin. Whoever you name, you need to make sure that they can make the decisions that you are asking them to make. Some examples of when medical power of attorneys may take effect are if something happens while you are under general anesthesia, you have a stroke, you go into a coma, anything like that where you cannot communicate. That's usually when you see them call the spouse or family members into the room and tell them what's going on and ask them what they want to do next. Now, if there's a medical power of attorney and you've had the conversations with this person, they already know what you want to do. If you know that some of your choices will cause an unusual amount of stress or guilt to the named party, maybe try to find another person or have a team of people who can consult to make a decision for you. Without this document, important decisions about your healthcare cannot happen, or they may be left to a person that you didn't want making those decisions, like a disgruntled ex. Ew. If you don't think making plans for what you want at the end of life, or if something happens and you are unable to make decisions for yourself isn't important, Google Terry Schiavo. Her case is a bit extreme and very heart-wrenching, but it's about a woman who was kept alive via artificial means for 15 years. The doctors who examined her tried various therapies over about a 3-year period while she was in a persistent vegetative state. The doctors finally affirmed, after all of their trying, that she would never come out of this coma or be able to breathe or function on her own. Her parents and her husband battled for years in court on whether to keep her alive, her parents, or to let her go, her husband. Though this ended in 2005 with the court siding with the husband and may be a bit extreme, it was very public. And it is an example of what can happen if you don't start making plans and assigning roles now. This actually caused a lot of change in the death care law. And respecting your time, I'll end here. There are many other things to think about when creating advanced directives and making end-of-life plans. I've only touched on a few, but hopefully the few that I've touched on is enough to get you thinking and to get you motivated and to get the wheels rolling. Because as the saying goes, time waits for no one. You don't want to be at the end of life finally asking or making end-of-life plans.